I changed my title and changed a little bit my topic, but as you will see, in a sense, it's kind of a comment of the preceding talk. It was not premeditated, but okay. I will begin by some consideration about C.S. Lewis' place in the history of analytic philosophy. C.S. Lewis is a peculiar figure in the landscape of contemporary philosophy. Curiously enough, the growing interest during the last decades for pragmatism and American philosophy in general left the last great pragmatist aside. Even though some of Lewis' classical pieces are included in recent overviews or ontology on pragmatism, Flowers and Murphy's assessment appears to be still valid. Quote, the name of C.S. Lewis lacks the currency of most of the American pragmatists. The kernel of truth in this diagnosis lies in the apparent disproportion between the embryonic state of the secondary literature on Lewis and the wide range of impact of his central philosophical insight on 20th century philosophers. Recently, only two books were devoted to Lewis: Murray Murphy's book, C.S. Lewis, the Last Great Pragmatist, and another one by Sandra Rosenthal, C.S. Lewis in Focus. And before the recently published Pragmatism in Transition, edited by Pete Olen and Carl Sachs, only three collections of essays were focused on Lewis. I think that Lewis' philosophical contributions were and are still mainly underrated. His best and major philosophical insights, some of them were revisited classical pragmatist insights, were explored, criticized, and made alive by a whole generation of major philosophers in America, including, for example, Cavell, Goodman, Kuhn, Papp, Putnam, Quine, Sellars, and the list is not closed. And in different and sometimes conflicting ways, all these philosophers acknowledge and appreciate what Cavell describes as, I quote, genuineness of philosophical inspiration in the teaching of C.I. Lewis. Not only Lewis holds a decisive, but not only a negative role in the formation of the post-World War II American philosophy, but he was also in fruitful dialogue with such touring figures as Russell, Carnap, Schlick, Ayer, Stebbing, or even Austin. And as Davidson once remarked, C.S. Lewis is a missing link between Kant and Quine. It's crucial to remind that Lewis' conceptual pragmatism is kind of a genius faced in that it bridges between different philosophical traditions and eras. But today my goal is not to go into this story. Instead, I'd like to propose two arguments about why C.S. Lewis' conceptual pragmatism is not to be identified to a variety of conventionalism. So it will be clear that my talk is a kind of comment of Lida's talk. It's not that the conventionalist reading is dominant or widespread today. I think it's not. But my strategy is instead to examine two anti-conventionalist arguments in C.S. Lewis in order to uncover two neglected aspects of his conceptual pragmatism. The first neglected aspect relates to his Platonism about, or his quasi-Platonism about concepts and meanings, and the second aspect relates to semantic externalism. But before going further, I'd like to provide some background. I want to expose the main claims of Lewis' conceptual pragmatism as they are defended in Mind and the World Order. Yeah. So this main claims of conceptual pragmatism are responses to a set of philosophical problems related to then-current scientific situation, that is to say to the new developments and orientations in logic, mathematics, and physics. Here I'm vaguely commenting the preface of Mind and World Order. According to Lewis, this new orientation do not offer any univocal lesson regarding the nature of the a priori and the relation between the conceptual and the empirical. Furthermore, there is no agreement, there were no agreement among philosophers about the central issues related to the notion of the a priori. Thus, an entire set of traditional philosophical issues needs to be reconsidered in a new light. I distinguished three problems following Lewis. First, the problem of the nature of the a priori, that is to say the problem of how to understand the analytic character of the a priori and its two internal features, the necessity and the independence from experience. Second problem, labeled by Lewis, the problem of the a priori, the problem of the application or the applicability of the a priori to experience. And the third problem, the problem of the validity of empirical knowledge, the problem of induction, of the human problem. The three main theses of conceptual pragmatism, as they are exposed in the preface of Mind and World Order, are the following. First thesis, the a priori is analytic, there is no synthetic a priori. A lot of arguments in the book are dedicated to explain what is to be understood by analytic here, and by the fact that there is no synthetic order to be imposed upon experience. And the second thesis, if the thesis according to which the application of any concept to experience is hypothetical, and the selection of a category of system or framework for such an application is pragmatically determined. And the third thesis, and I quote, is that experience in general is such as to be capable of conceptual interpretation, requires no peculiar or metaphysical assumption about the conformity of experience to the mind and its category. Yeah, I think so. It could not be conceivably be otherwise. The third thesis contends that there is no problem of world order as it was assumed in the traditional framing of the problem of the a priori and in the traditional framing of the problem of induction. The third thesis encapsulates Lewis' answer to the problem of the a priori and to the human problems. A major concern thus for Lewis in Mind and World Order is to show how and why the first and second thesis are entirely compatible with the validity of cognition. That is to say, how and why they are compatible with the claim that no peculiar and metaphysical assumption about the conformity of experience to the mind could be helpful or would be needed in order to address the problem of the a priori and the human problem. So, contrary to the widespread and now standard reading of Mind and World Order, focused on the concept-given distinction, and thus on the chapter 2 and 3 of Mind and World Order, I locate the core of conceptual pragmatism in chapter 7, 8, and 11, as they contain the crucial elements of Lewis overcoming of the traditional world order problem. I think that it's the right interpretation, of course. So now why read Lewis as a conventionalist and how to do so? One of the best arguments for conventionalist reading of Sir Lewis would be to propose a conventionalist reading of the core of conceptual pragmatism, that is to say, the pragmatic conception of the a priori. One of the best, maybe, textual evidence is this passage from the essay A Pragmatic Conception of a Priori, but a quasi-same passage is to be found in Mind and World Order in chapter 7. I quote, what is a priori is necessary truth, not because it compels the mind acceptance, but precisely because it does not. The a priori represent an attitude in some sense freely taken, a stipulation of the mind itself, and a stipulation which might be made in some other way, if it suits or bent or need. Such truth is necessary as opposed to contingent, not as opposed to voluntary. This quotation encapsulates Lewis' treatment of the problem of the nature of the a priori, and it emphasizes the practical and the pragmatic dimension of the a priori. More specifically, it hinges upon his reconsumption of the necessity specific to the a priori and to the categories. According to Lewis, the major mistake in the traditional conception is to misunderstand the relation of the a priori to the mind by misconstruing the necessity specific to the a priori. In partial support to this claim, Lewis proposes to distinguish between two exceptions of the word necessary, whether the necessary is opposed to the contingent or to the voluntary. This distinction enables him to argue that the necessity specific to the a priori is not to be opposed to the voluntary, but to the contingent. Philosophers traditionally mistake the necessity specific to the a priori for the involuntary or for that which imposes itself upon us. This negative moment of Lewis' argument is partly directed against the rationalist prejudice, according to which the a priori is an absolute datum imposed on us, found by us, and forming some kind of integral part of the standard constitution of the mind, something equivalent to what Royce labels the absolute modes of the rational activity. As Lewis suggests, traditional conceptions of the a priori have handily ascribed to the a priori features specific to the given, for the reason that they were not clear enough about the concept-given distinction. The given is indeed that which the mind must accept willy-nilly, and that which we do not have laid down. Positive moment of his argument is contained in the far-reaching philosophical consequences drawn by Lewis from this reconception of the necessity specific to the a priori. I quote, the a priori has its origin in an act of mind. It has in some sense the character of fiat and is in some respects like deliberate choice. The a priori is a peculiar possession of mind because it bears the stamp of mind's creation. And the criterion of creativity is not inevitability, but exactly its opposite, the absence of impulsion and the presence of at least considerable alternatives. So, the a priori does not have its origin in the mind as an element of its standard constitution, but as a result of its active nature and as an attitude of the mind itself. So, considerations that are traditionally connected to practical reason prove to be relevant for the problem of the nature of the a priori. It's why I distinguish between the practical dimension of the a priori and the pragmatic distinction of the a priori. I think it's crucial because it enables us to distinguish two distinct legacies of Royce's characterization of categories. So if there is no such a thing as taking an attitude or acting in a certain way where there is no room for alternative attitudes or alternative ways of acting, then there is no such a thing as an a priori or a category of framework without considerable alternatives. This practical conception of the a priori is integral to Lewis' pluralism. It's true that he inherits his characterization of the categories as ways of acting from Royce, but Lewis takes, it's also true that he takes the absolute pragmatism of Royce he considers that this pragmatism does not do justice to the pluralistic dimension of this characterization. So Lewis emphasizes on the stipulative, or as I sometimes put it, on the definitive dimension of the a priori, and his use of the vocabulary of the fiat, deliberate choice, decision, has led some to argue that Lewis holds a conventionalist view on the a priori. That is to say, a view on which a priori truth, in general, are made true by a specific kind of convention. As an example of such an interpretation, I would like to take a paper by Sean Morris, a recent paper, which is not the paper directly on Lewis, but on Quine, on truth by convention. I take this paper as an example because it exposes one of the most elaborated reading of Lewis as a conventionalist, and this reading is used in order to account for a decisive moment in the history of analytic philosophy, or in the formation of analytic philosophy. The primary aim of Morris' essay is to fill a gap in the exegesis of Quine's truth by convention. Several interpreters have argued that Carnap's logical syntax was not Quine's target in that essay. Then who did Quine have in mind as a target of his criticism in Truth by Convention? The guiding question of Morris' essay. Against the strawman interpretation, Morris argued that Lewis was Quine's primary target. To support this line of interpretation, he devotes a whole section of his essay to defend a conventionalist reading of Lewis' pragmatic conception of the a priori. For the most part, his argumentation consists in inferring that Lewis held a conventionalist view from the fact that Lewis takes the a priori principle in general as emerging from legislative or stipulative acts of the mind, and thus as admitting conceivable alternatives. The relevant notion of convention at stake is then the notion of legislative postulation as it is defined by Quine in Carnap and Logical Truth. So, whereas discursive, what Quine calls discursive postulation, is, I quote Quine, mere selection for pre-existing body of truth of certain ones for use as a basis from which to derive others, legislative postulation properly hints of truth by convention, or institutes truth by convention. So Lewis' stipulative or definitive act of the mind by which a priori principle are set up would be legislative postulation in Quine's mind, in Quine's sense. Morris' interpretation surely has been influenced by Quine's Carnap lecture, and most particularly by the opening paragraphs of the first lecture entitled The A Priori. I will read the relevant passage. Carnap's central doctrine, which is the main concern of these lectures, is a doctrine that philosophy is syntax. In this hour, I shall lead up to that doctrine by discussing the analytic character of the a priori. I will present none of Carnap's actual work this time, but will attempt only to put the mentioned doctrine in a suitable setting. So he's clearly targeting Carnap. He's not. There is a misunderstanding of I think of the. Even if Quine is misunderstanding Carnap, maybe, and Lewis also. I think he tried to expose Carnap logical syntax in such a way that it would be acceptable for his audience. Well, I will go directly to the end of the quotation. Development of foundational studies empties out the a priori synthetics. The analytic and the a priori become coextensive. Thus, Professor Lewis writes, the a priori is not a material truth, delimiting or delineating the content of experience as such, but is definitive or analytic in its nature. The suitable setting for exposing CANAP's logical syntax is a sort of conventionalist reading of C.I. Lewis. It's as if the conventionalist conception of the a priori and of the analytic was a common ingredient to CANAP's logical syntax and to Lewis' pragmatic conception. For several reasons, highlighted in particular by Tom Baldwin, to bring Lewis and CANAP together may be justified. They both reject the traditional conception of the a priori, they both emphasize the importance of acknowledging the possibility and the existence of alternatives to our present conceptual framework, and accordingly, they both do justice to a certain logical pluralism. I will not go into the details of a comparison between CANAP and Lewis. I will instead turn to the reason why I take this conventionalist reading of Lewis as misleading. Of course, there is a kernel of truth in this reading. Lewis emphasizes a certain arbitrariness and autonomy of our a priori principles, and he brings into evidence that there is no sense to a system of a priori principle and to its objectivity without there being conceivable alternatives to it. But even if it would constitute necessary conditions for Lewis being qualified as a conventionalist, it surely does not constitute sufficient conditions. The most evident reason why the picture of Lewis as a conventionalist is unsatisfactory is that it does not give its due place to the pragmatic dimension of the a priori. That is to say, to the fundamental idea that our a priori principles are answerable to pragmatic criteria. I don't want to spell out why it is so, since it's a well-known and a well-documented aspect of Lewis' conception. Instead, I want to explore two arguments that are central to Lewis' conceptual pragmatism, but that have been neglected in the literature. The first argument is exposed in My Own World Order without being directed against a conventionalist account of the a priori, whereas later in Analysis of Knowledge and Evaluation, the conventionalist account was the main target, as Lydia showed this just before. So, the conventionalist reading of C.I. Lewis' conception of the a priori relied partly on an interpretation of the constitutive role granted to the will. The a prioricity and necessity express an attitude, in some sense, pre-taken, a stipulation of the mind itself. To assert that P is an a priori truth or principle, it is to express one's determination to hold P true no matter what. But Lewis explicitly endorses a position on which the role of the will in the constitution of the a priori is downplayed. I quote, there is a lot of quote, a lot of passage like this, but I think this one is most eloquent. Categories and concepts do not literally change. They are simply given up and replaced by new ones. Categories and precise concepts are logical structures, Platonic ideas. The implications of them are eternal. I distinguish four claims in this passage. First, concepts and their identity are unalterable, they are Platonic ideas. Second, their use and application are determined according to pragmatic criteria. Third, since analytic and a priori truth are definitive and express logical relation between concepts, these truths are absolute, eternal, unalterable. These are epithets used by Lewis in both his two masterpieces. And fourth, the relation between alternative systems of a priori and categorical principles is not a relation of contradiction between an old truth and a new truth in the diachronic case, or between our truth and their truth in the synchronic case, but a relation such that either a system of a priori principle is abandoned or given up and replaced by another, or a system of a priori principles is used instead of another one. So in my underworld order, Lewis' conception of concepts and meaning seems to be quasi-Platonist, in that the role of stipulation is not constitutive of meanings. Thus, his conception is not easily classified as a conventionalist one without distortions or omissions. Let me turn now to analysis of knowledge and valuation. In this book, this realism or Platonism, or I think I prefer Platonism. This Platonism, it will be clear later why I prefer Platonism. This realism about concepts and meanings is much more prominent and elaborated due to the explicitness of Lewis' rejection of conventionalism. One of the explicit aims of the book is to refute the, I quote, nominalism which regards meanings as no more than the creature of linguistic convention. Against this, Lewis wants to delineate a sense of meaning in which meanings, or a meaning of meaning, as he said, in which meanings and concepts can be neither instituted nor modified, while at the same time acknowledging the possibility of alternative systems, or classificatory systems, of linguistic symbols. Well, his opposition to conventionalism is explicit in several passages. I just quote the following one. The symbols used and the relations of them and assignment of them to symbolization of meanings are matters determined by convention. Also, what classification should be made and what meanings entertained are matters subject to decision. But the meaning entertained are as they are and not otherwise, whether they should be entertained or not. And the relation of meanings, once these meanings are themselves fixed, or these meanings themselves are fixed, is something which no decision of ours or no mode of symbolization can affect. So, even though it's a matter of convention or legislation that a symbol has a meaning it does, Lewis denied that analytic truth was truth by convention. All squares are rectangle is analytically true by virtue of the sense meaning of square and rectangle, that is to say, by virtue of the inclusion of the criterion for applying rectangle in the criterion for applying square. This is the decisive point to my mind is that this logical relation of inclusion is not at all a matter of convention. As he puts it in the preface, once the meanings of a symbolic system are fixed, one can no more modify these meanings or their relations than one can modify the facts of existence by talking about them in different languages. So Lewis agrees with the traditional conception of analytic truth, or truth which is determined explicitly or implicitly by meaning alone. But he considers that the conventionalist fails to distinguish between linguistic meaning and sense meaning, and that the conventionalist gives too much weight to symbolic definition at the expense of explicative definitions. So contrary to symbolic definition, for example, the Russian definition that relates a symbol to a symbol, or to a dictionary definition that relates a symbol to a meaning, an explicative definition is a real definition that relates a meaning to a meaning. Two aspects of intentional meanings are related in such definitions: the linguistic meaning, that is the pattern of analytic relations between an expression and other expressions, and the sense meaning, that is the criterion in mind, which determines the application of a term or proposition, and by which what is meant is to be recognized. So analytic truth do not merely state a relation between linguistic meanings, but also an overall logical relation between sense meanings. Because the conventionalist view of analyticity neglects real definition, analyticity of a statement is only relative to purely formal symbolic convention, according to Lewis. So among many difficulties, the conventionalist has to face the following one. On the one hand, she asserts that the a priori is coextensive with analytic, but on the other hand, she's not able to do justice to the epistemic dimension of the a priori, that is to say, to its applicability to experience. So let's take stock. Whereas in Mind, the World Order, Lewis, Platonism about concepts and meaning is not directly articulated to an anti-conventionalist stance, in analysis, this anti-conventionalism works as a sort of negative justification of his Platonism. Second point, Lewis' rejection of the Canapian linguistic or syntactic term is encapsulated in the logical and epistemological primacy of sense meaning over linguistic meaning. And this primacy makes his conception of analyticity a non-linguistic and non-conventionalist conception. And third point, in Mind the World Order, while no a priori and no categories are dictated either by experience or by a standard constitution of the mind, they nevertheless answer to a criteria of the general type, which may be termed pragmatic, that is, criteria related to the fulfillment of specifically human needs and hands. But in his second masterpiece, in Analysis, the pragmatic element of knowledge is somewhat downplayed, and the struggle against conventionalism makes Lewis endorsing a kind of Platonism about meanings in order to answer to the threat of arbitrariness and formalism related to his notion of definitive or legislative a priori. In the light of the preceding consideration, one may consider that the coherence, the very coherence of Lewis' conceptual pragmatism is undermined by two tensions. The first tension is between two strands in his conception of necessity and a prioricity. That is, between his realism about, or his Platonism about concepts and meanings, and the practical and pragmatic aspect of his conception. Of course, one way out of this difficulty is to argue that even though meanings and concepts are not depending on us for the existence and the identity, what is up to us and is determined by pragmatic criteria is a choice and the use of a set of meaning relations to be expressed by our symbolic powers. The second tension lies between his Platonism about concepts, on which prima facie concepts are not depending on social institutions, and his characterization of the pure concept as, I quote, Mind the World Order, the pure concept as that meaning which must be common to two minds when they understand each other by the use of some substantive or its equivalent. It's page 70. In Mind the World Order, concepts are taken to be shared meanings expressed in a common language, and they contribute to our common world. This sharing of meanings hangs on an agreement in judgments, since mutual understanding primarily requires that, I quote again, in general, well, we are able to discriminate and relate as others do when confronted by the same situation. It's very close to the first chapter of World and Object. Once again, one could argue that there is no tension, since it's not said that this meaning, which must be common to two minds, are depending for their existence and identity upon social institution. In the essay, The Pragmatic Element of in Knowledge, which was published in 1926, so a little bit earlier, just before Mind the World Order, Lewis distinguishes between two ways of understanding the Platonic nature of concepts. Either we are, I quote, reminded of them by experience, as in Plato, or what is more likely, so against the quote, we invent or formulate them ourselves. But Lewis argues in this essay, this difference does not matter for how to understand the notion of a priori and analyticity. In Mind the World Order, this distinction is not mentioned by Lewis, But he explicitly rejects Plato's understanding of the nature and identity of concepts, as in the beginning of analysis of knowledge and valuation. Lewis is surely right in refusing to take concepts as a transcendent and separated entities. In that, in taking them to be so, he would have to explain our access to such concepts and meanings, and also he would have to explain how to solve the problem of coordinating the individual assignations of meanings to expressions. Two problems that, according many commentators, can be found in Frege's or Russell's philosophy. For all that, he seems to confront with a dilemma. Either we invent or create concepts and meanings, but in that case, it's difficult to understand how this is compatible with analytic and a priori truth being eternally true. Or we do not invent or create concepts and meanings, but we find them, we select them, and we use them. And their relations stated in the a priori principles obtained independently of our adoption of them for the purpose of classifications. Okay, but it leads to at least two difficulties. First, since concepts are not to be identified with transcendent and separated entities, but are still Platonic ideas whose logical relations are eternally true, the question of their logical and epistemological status is all the more pressing. Indeed, to suppose that these concepts and meanings are, for example, part of the constitution of the mind is not only implausible, to be a view close to the one held by Fodor, for example. It's strange, but... So, to suppose that these concepts are part of the constitution of the mind is not only implausible, but it flies in the face of Lewis' explicit rejection of an invariant constitution of the mind, and of the rejection of the idea that the a priori truth and our categories are something like a datum, something that can be found some way or another. The second difficulty is the following. Let's say we do not invent concepts and meanings and their relations obtained independently of our selection and use of them. Then it seems that we have to accept that there is a predeterminate range of all alternative systems of a priori principles available to us. Otherwise, it seems difficult, or it seems to me at least, difficult to account for variations in terms of system of a priori principle, or to account for revolutionary changes in science, or to radically differences in conceptual schemes. But this position apparently implies that it would be conceivable for anyone to anticipate all possible forms or modes of thought, even the ones that were once taken as unintelligible or that are taken as unintelligible. But without the assumption of something analogous to a Leibnizian God, I do not see how to make sense of this implication. My second argument has to do with Lewis' somewhat ambivalent relation to semantic externalism. Lewis has sometimes been understood as adhering to a version of the traditional theory of meaning, as endorsing two assumptions of the traditional theory of meaning as a were identified by Putnam in The Meaning of Meaning. So knowing the meaning of a term is just a matter of being in a certain psychological state, and the meaning of a term determine its extension. There is a quotation which goes in this direction. We shall wish to preserve this original sense of intention, the intention as what is intended, and specifically to identify it with a criterion in mind by which it is determined whether the term in question applies or fails to apply in any particular instance. Even though I think that it's right that Lewis explicitly endorses these two assumptions of the traditional theory of mind, I don't think that it's a whole story about Lewis' relation to semantic externalism. I think that it's to consider that the whole story it's kind of side effect of being too narrowly focused on Lewis' analysis of knowledge and valuation. And I think that the most important insight of Lewis' philosophy are to be found in his first book. Let me explain. As Putnam formulates it, the traditional principle of determination is the principle on which the extension of a term is being determined by its meaning rather than vice versa. That's to say that there is no road back from extension to meaning. One of the main lessons of Putnam externalism is then that this traditional principle is untenable. The point is sometimes formulated in his term of thought being world-involving. Our social and natural environment contributes to the possibility of our thought having a grip on the world or partially determines what is for some of our assertions of thought to be evaluated in terms of truth and falsity. What about Lewis what is the relation with Lewis? In Man and the World Order, Lewis repeatedly claims that some general natural features of the world are presupposed by our successful use of our a priori principle and categories. That such facts are presupposed means that the world contributes to the possibility for empirical epistemological claims to be evaluated in terms of truth and falsity by conditioning the application of our a priori principle to the experience.
Thank you. The last slide that you had there said that a priori principles presuppose certain features of the world. But then I thought in your original presentation of mind and world order, the idea was that the a priori principles do not depend on any special assumptions about the world. Can you connect those two points?
It could be considered as a contradiction if we consider that the a priori is defined as something that is independent from experience. So if it's independent from experience, how it could, in a sense, be dependent on a feature of the world? I think the important point here, it was an objection formulated in the first review of Manuel's book, and I think we have to distinguish between different sense of what is to be independent from experience. What Lewis is arguing that the a priori is not depending of general feature of the world. Although it's something that that can be found also in Rauschenbach. The point and the usefulness of a measurement procedure is in some sense depending on some behavior of nature. And in that sense, there is a kind of dependency of our procedures on some feature of the world that are not local and isolated feature, but that are general and recurrent feature, and this in Lewis, this point is used to explain that For a category to be applicable to experience, and in the sense that a category is a guide for action, so category is related to our specifically human needs and purposes. And so for a category to be applicable,
Can I give a precise example? So one concept would be of the length of an object, and presumably this would come with certain criteria that I would implement to determine the length of an object, and experience might not cooperate in the sense that I might keep trying and I don't get consistent results or something like that. So would that be a case where the associated a priori principles are refuted, or is that a case where they cannot be successfully applied?
From Lewis's point of view, they will not be refuted. Because the relation is that the relation, or to put this in another way, the relation of categories to experience is in one sense a relation of independence, because a priori is not derived from experience, but in another sense, it's not derived, and a priori is not refuted by or falsified by experience. But in the sense, if experience were other in some of its features, some of our categories would lose their point and their interest, and they could not be applicable.
Yes. Okay. That's helpful.
And I think this distinction is crucial. And Lewis makes explicitly the distinction in the introduction and later in this discussion about Mill. You want to criticize Mill empiricism in arithmetic, this distinction plays a great role in his criticism of Mill, because he doesn't want to say that our way of adding are depending on experience, as Mill is supposed to as in Mill's position, but he wants to say that if we were jellyfish in a liquid world, as you say, maybe we would not add in the same sense as we add in this world.
Okay, thank you.
So I agree with everything you said, with the possible exception of the semantic externalism, just because you didn't have time to elaborate. But I wanted to ask a little bit about the idea of conventionalism that's at play here, because there's a certain way that I could think about the account that you've given, which I think is, you know, incredibly deeply rooted in the text, that where I could say, well, look, you've presented an account according to which Lewis is entirely not a conventionalist. Like, you've defended him completely from the type of conventionalist that Quine thought he was. But there's another type of conventionalism, or there's a sort of more sympathetic understanding of conventionalism, where I think Lewis still isn't going to turn out to be a conventionalist, but it might be a slightly harder thing to prove. So just as an example, at some point you were talking about that Lewis himself said that conventionalists in some sense neglect the sense meaning of certain concepts. Like, well, but Poincaré does not neglect the sense meaning of concepts. Poincaré has the, you know, the expanding gas sphere and the, you know, the expanding and contracting measuring devices that go along with it. And he has, Poincaré is extremely careful about, you know, the different sense meanings of different geometries or something like that. And so I could think of a kind of convention. And so if we think that Poincaré is conventionalist, which we may or may not, right, then, you know, then Lewis could be read as that kind of a conventionalist. But then I think that's not what Quine is talking about, because Quine is talking about something where we have completely arbitrary conventions that we just pick and we just sort of hold on to them come what may, and there's absolutely no way of, like, actually being careful about how they're applied to experience. And so I think, in a sense, I think this is what I would want to sort of pull apart, is, like, Quine's kind of highly arbitrary reading of conventionalism in the case, like, Truth by Convention, and some sort of deeper reading of like, Poincaré and other people who were working on, like, conventionalist interpretations of geometry and so forth. And so do you think that that might be a sort of a way of explaining, like, why Quine would have thought that Lewis was an example of this, but he was wrong? Or, I mean, I guess that's sort of my question.
Thank you. First, a clarification. I think I should have precise that I try to see to examine what Lewis conceives as a conventionalist position, and what objection he has against
okay.
such a position. But I don't think that his position on conventionalism is so caricatural or so unfair. So. Because it points.
Lewis or Quine, though? Because I was saying Quine's was a caricature, not Lewis's
necessarily. Yeah, but
yeah.
In the beginning of the, I think of the I don't remember where, but analysis of knowledge and volition, Lewis at some point he gives a characterization of conventionalism, and immediately after he says that. Maybe nobody will fit to this characterization,
okay.
But he has objections that really fits to some of Schlick's remarks, some of Carnap's remarks, and his realism or his Platonism could also be understood as a way to depart from. Carnap principle of tolerance, because the only criteria. I will stop here for this. Now for Quine. I'm not sure that at the beginning of the first lecture, first Carnap lecture. I think why to my mind he has a faulty conventionalist reading of Lewis, because Lewis will not grant this kind of implicit definition procedure that can be applied to every body of knowledge. I'm not sure it will. In that sense, it's not really. It's not my Lewis. And in Truth by Convention, since Truth by Convention is a rewriting of the first lecture, I think the same point will apply.
Yeah. So again. So I'm just going to follow up quickly and then I'll, yeah, sorry. But I think, no, I agree. I just wonder, I think that you can be 100% correct and Quine can be wrong. And so I think that I guess would
but,
be my own.
But it maybe it doesn't imply that Quine was wrong in his criticism of Lewis.
Okay.
Maybe I'm not coherent. Awesome.
We can have one more question.
Sorry, another question about the shared meanings or the social aspects of the meanings. So one objection is that we can only learn what meanings other people have in mind by observing their behavior. But these behaviors that we can see underdetermine which meanings these other people have in mind. And so if Lewis is correct, then meanings can never really be shared because we can't learn what other people mean by their words. It looked like that was the sort of objection you were developing at one point, but I didn't understand if you thought that Lewis had a reply or if you thought he just wasn't focused on that issue. So do you think that problem of learning shared meanings or acquiring them through behavior is a problem for Lewis?
I think it's a problem for Lewis, for anyone who holds a view on which meanings are independent from the existence and the identity from our social relations or from the constitution of our mind. I think it's a problem. And in Lewis, there is a real anti-psychologism in mind, the world order, and there is knowledge and relation. And he had two arguments, and arguments according to which meanings are socially constituted, and are not reducible to, or concepts are not reducible to impressions or to Vorstellungen in Frege's sense. So this argument is very close to Frege's argument against psychology in Der Gedanke. But on the other side, he has also this argument, this Platonist argument. But this Platonist argument leads directly, to my mind, to the difficulty of how to access to this meaning or to these concepts, even if it's not separated entities, as he claims. And the other problem is how to ensure that we all here we assign the same meaning to the same expression. It's a kind of coordination, of social coordination. I don't see how we can once you hold such a view, you can reply to this problem. I don't see.
Thank you.